When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello there, welcome back. This is part two of the Donner Party, so if you've listened to the first part, welcome back. If you haven't listened to the first part, I think you should probably go back and listen, because you're not really going to understand what's going on. Just a quick one, if you are listening, if you're a follow on, you don't need this warning. If you're just coming into the second part, just a heads up, there is some graphic detail in this one, and it may not be suitable for people who have a nervous disposition or young listeners.
So, this is where we've left them. They've turned back to the lake.
Yes. Part two.
Yeah.
Yeah, welcome back.
Breen family took up residence in the existing cabin by the lake. Now, this lake would eventually be named after the group. All right, so if you're looking at it on the map, it is now called the Donner Lake.
Is it? They didn't know that.
So you've got the Breen family have gone into the cabin. The Kessebergs, they built a lean-to against one of the walls of this cabin. And that was for the Kesseberg family.
Mm-hmm.
And they were joined by Spitzer and a gentleman called Berger. The cabin itself was in poor condition. It needed a lot of work to make it habitable. A couple of hundred yards upstream, William Eddy and William Foster built a double cabin for their families, while the Reeds and the Graves built their own double cabin half a mile away. So we've now got three cabins, but they're spread out.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got the original one. Then you've got a couple of hundred yards upstream on the side of the lake, another one. And then, you know, half a mile away, a third one.
Yeah. So they're getting there.
You're getting there. Once they turned back to the lake.
Yeah.
It started to snow. This snowstorm lasted 8 days.
Jesus.
So not only did they miss getting to the pass by 24 hours, they then had 8 days of snow. But they didn't stop. You know, several attempts were made to find a route through the mountains, each one driven back by the snow and the wind.
Yeah.
Because the wind is howling through that.
Well, they're
through
on a those plane, mountains. Aren't they?
Yeah, that's
Oh, no,
it.
They're on the mountains, aren't they? Sorry.
The Donner family, they didn't fare much better. They were a couple of days further back.
Yeah.
But the main group sent someone back to the Donners to tell them that, you know, the pass is now blocked and they were there for the winter, so they were going to have to build a cabin for themselves.
Yeah.
So it was nice of them.
Yeah.
You didn't have to, but they, because the Donner party were now behind. There was a problem with that. George Donner had injured his hand.
Mm.
Jacob Donner,
yeah, you meant
his brother, was basically next to useless.
Yeah.
Right. The weather quickly overtook them, and the Donner party had to make do with hastily thrown up tents. And they got these tents. And they made three separate sort of areas. So there were three basic tents. There were 21 people in this group. Now they're not tents as you would think of them. They're not like your Indian teepees. I say Indian, Native Americans. We call them. We still call them Indians over here. Yeah. But I understand that that may not be appropriate in America. No. So I'm not sure how to refer to these people. So well, we call them Native Americans. They're teepees.
It's not something we have to worry about, is it? It's not part of our culture. So
no. So they weren't tents. They're not scout tents either.
No.
You know, they were what's known as brush sheds is the way to describe them. Pine branches were placed around the trunk of a tree, very much like a teepee. So you've just got basically wooden branches
around
a central post, that central post being a tree. That's your tent.
Yeah, that's not okay. Really great in the middle of winter, is it?
No. The Donner camp was actually 7 miles from the Reeds camp.
So that's roughly a 3-day walk at their pace.
Winter had truly arrived. Temperatures dropped and the ground froze. Ground was solid. The Donna Reed party had missed the opportunity to cross the Sierra Nevada mountain range by one day. Now they're trapped on the wrong side of that range. They'd travelled over 2,500 miles and were less than 100 miles from Sutter's Fort. Sutter's Fort, believe it or not, was actually mentioned in the Gold Rush.
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was.
Sutter was the man
who ran through the town. Yeah. Was that the one who ran through the town with?
He was the original gentleman whose land the gold was found on.
Oh, that's the one, yeah.
Yeah? Anyway. Yeah. But they were only 100 miles from Sutter's Fort. It might as well have been the 2,500 because they got there. There were 81 people now stranded on the wrong side of the mountains, and over half of them were under 18. Most of those were infants or young children.
Yeah.
And they're the wrong side of the mountains in the snow. 3 attempts were made to get over the summit of the mountain and into the pass in the first couple of weeks. None were ultimately successful. People tried. The animals were too weak from hunger. There was a minimum of 3 feet of snow on the ground all the time. And on occasions, only the animal's neck and head could be seen above the snow.
That's deep, isn't it?
The animals could not pull the wagons.
No.
So the oxen were packed with the wagon's contents. So they left the wagons.
Yeah.
Oxen now are their only more form of transport. There were arguments about what should be left behind. The children had to be carried.
Yeah.
On the last attempt of the three that we were talking about, Charles Stanton and the two Indians, Louis and Salvador, went ahead and actually made it to the top. But breaking a new trail in the deep snow was exhausting. Doing it uphill and not knowing the route to take made it harder. The snow was chest deep at the summit, but they made it. They returned back to the party. We got it. We're there. We've got the route. Let's go. Yeah. Everybody else was resting around a flaming dead tree. I don't mean a flaming dead tree. I mean they'd set fire to a tree.
Yeah. I don't think the Americans use flaming as a...
a swear word.
Yeah. I don't think they'd use it as we do.
No. Well, that's an English thing. You would say flaming this, flaming that. That's a mild swear word, so you know,
yeah,
they were climbing around a flaming tree. Okay. They were using this as a measure of warmth, and they refused to leave the fire to climb up to the pass, so they stayed at the camp.
Yep. And by probably a day after, that trail was gone because it would have been buried in snow again.
Mm-hmm. Remember, the camp wasn't all in one place. It was 3 encampments spread over several miles.
Yeah.
And if you think things had been difficult up to this point, they were going to get a whole lot worse. With the arrival of winter, there was now absolutely no way for the members of the Donna Reed party to make it over the mountain range. Now, we actually have a detailed account of what life was like at the camps because one of the party, Patrick Breen, kept a diary. He started writing a diary. And his first entry was, came to this place on the 31st of last month. It snowed. We went on to the pass. The snow, so deep we were unable to find the road. When within 3 miles of the summit. Then turned back to this shanty on the lake. We've killed the most part of our cattle, having to stay here until next spring and live on poor beef without bread or salt. It snowed during the space of 8 days with little intermission after our arrival here. And that's his first entry. Don't sound brilliant.
Pretty depressing, you know, actually.
He's pissed off.
Yeah.
You know, I think I would be.
Yeah.
Life was clearly untenable at the lake for the Donna party in the winter of 46, 47. They were trapped in the snow. They were dispirited. They were exhausted. They were scared. There wasn't enough food. They weren't working together. Mistakes compounded mistakes. All three attempts by small groups to escape and get help in California failed. It snowed, and it snowed, and it snowed. It was exceptionally cold. They lived in filth, and they were utterly miserable. They were trapped by 20 feet of snow at the lake. Mm. See, you're now talking house height snow.
Yeah. So these, yeah. And if you're in a tent or a house, you're buried in that. There's no
answer.
There's no way out. That's it. You're in there until that snow melts or someone carves you out.
I mean, this was well beyond what they had ever experienced, ever heard of, or even dreamed of at the start when they left Illinois.
Yeah.
On the western side of the mountains, James Reed left Fort Sutter with a rescue party in attempt. He's going to reach his family, and I'm going in from the other side. I'm going to reach the party from the east. We know they're there.
Yeah.
They've got to be there.
And it's his family, so you would.
You know. They didn't fare much better.
No.
They got bogged down by the snow. In fact, the Indian guides that they took with them deserted soon after, taking three of the pack horses with them. They just took them. That's it, gone. And soon the remaining animals dropped from exhaustion and died in the snow. This is the rescue party. The saddle horses also gave out, and for a short time, the remaining men pressed on in foot. With a single mule carrying the supplies, they got one animal left. Within a day of that, they knew it was useless to go on. They had to turn around and go back.
Yeah.
On the 16th of December, 17 people decided they were going to try to head for California from the party, from the Donna Reed party. 14 of them on homemade snowshoes.
Yeah.
They had a little bit of savvy.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite clever.
You can't walk on snow easily.
No, you've got to spread it out.
You've got to spread your weight out. So they fashioned some form of snowshoes.
Yeah.
It's like, well, I think the modern day ones are like massive tennis rackets on your feet, aren't they?
I think that's pretty much what they were. I think they used sticks and beef. Was it beef rind?
Something like that. Yeah. 17 of them. Only 14 had snowshoes.
So 3 of them were fucked before they even left.
Basically. This group would become known later on, when the story eventually comes out, as the Forlorn Hope.
Mm-hmm.
They left on the 16th of December to try and get to California. That night, it snowed at the camp. Again.
Yep. Oh, just quickly, because obviously this is part two. In part one, we gave a little disclaimer about graphic details and things like that. It's kind of irrelevant for part one. It's mainly for like the next part. So if you've listened to part one and you have and you've come in, you know that obviously there's a disclaimer about that. If you haven't listened to part one and you're only listening to part two, there is a disclaimer here. There is scenes that may be upsetting to some listeners. Let's put it that way. So anyway, carry on. Sorry, I just wanted to get, because obviously it's a two-part episode, isn't it? I just wanted to make sure.
Forlorn hope. I don't know if your American listeners would actually know that about that, but it's a military term. It's usually used to describe a group sent on a near almost suicide mission where there's known to be a very, very small chance.
Isn't that what they're called
of
now,
success?
Though? Is that where it's come from because of them?
No.
No. Okay.
It was the first time I remember it being used was during the Napoleonic Wars in the late 1700s, where basically if you were going to attack a castle or an encampment, a fort, you wouldn't send your best troops first.
Yeah.
So what you would do is you would get all the criminals and the people you didn't like, make them into a unit and sling them at it.
Yeah.
And that group used to be called the Forlorn Hope. So if you ever picked for the Forlorn Hope, the chances of survival were very, very low. But if you did survive, you were the hero.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what it means. That's where the term comes from, British-wise. I don't know if there's an American version, but that's the British version of it.
Fair enough.
So we've now got 17 people leaving, but it's snowing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. This Forlorn Hope took 6 days of food with them, and they knew that it would take at least 10 days to reach California.
So they haven't taken enough food anyway.
They each carried a blanket and had amongst them one rifle, a couple of pistols, a hatchet, and finger-sized strips of meat that were basically intended to last for 6 days.
It's like beef jerky, basically.
Yeah. So you could have two strips three times a day. That would last you 6 days.
Okay.
Not a lot of nutrition, not a lot of, you know. They knew this, but they also believed that they could survive a couple of days without food, which would enable them to reach their goal. Even so, the going was extremely hard, and the constant snow caused problems. The cold and the wind and 20 foot of snow ain't exactly the best way to start walking.
No.
Especially up a mountain. The blankets they had quickly became soaked and heavy and just didn't provide any warmth whatsoever. They had no other shelter than the blankets they had, and they had to sleep on the ground.
In the snow.
In the snow.
Just stupid.
The wagon ruts that would have marked the trail,
yeah,
were completely covered in snow, up to 20 feet deep. So the only way they knew where to go was George Stanton, because he'd come back.
Yeah.
So he'd travelled the route, albeit the opposite direction. But he'd gone across the mountain before the snow arrived. Mm-hmm. He came back before the snow got there. But he knew the route.
Yeah.
It's not good having one person, though.
Not really, no.
And they had to rely on George Stanton. But at least he'd done it. I mean, straight away, it's too much for two of the group.
Yeah.
Billy Murphy, who was aged 10, gave up and decided to head home. Day one. 10 years old.
I mean, that's mental, isn't it? Taking a 10-year-old on that.
Dutch Charlie gave up, but nobody noticed his absence for a few hours. They assumed that he'd headed back with Billy, but in reality, he'd actually got lost. Mm. He did actually make it back to the lake, but it was a day after Billy had got back.
So he did make it, but...
This left 15 in the group. And only one 12-year-old. Lemuel Murphy. And guess what those three had in common?
They were all kids.
They were all without snowshoes.
The kids didn't have snowshoes. So it was the kids that... I mean, that's even worse, isn't it, really?
Yeah. So, 12-year-old Lemuel Murphy was the only one left without snowshoes. That first night, the group huddled together with only their blankets for protection. Mm. When they woke the following morning, everyone was covered in about a foot of snow.
Brilliant.
They continued on the trail, but it was now completely covered with snow, and it's just going was so slow. Within a few days, though, they made it over the summit. And they made it several miles into the valley, where the snow was only 11 foot deep.
Oh, only two people deep then.
Then, as predicted, on the sixth day, the food ran out.
See, now you would think, if you've bought enough food for 6 days, knowing that it's going to take about 10 days, you wouldn't eat it. Though you'd try and go like the first day, right? First day, we're not going to eat anything. Second day, we might eat something. Third day, maybe not. Do you know what I mean? You'd stretch it out. You wouldn't go, right, 6 days we'll eat, and then the last four, nothing. Because that's just... stupid, isn't it?
But they thought that they would get there within, you know,
they just
4 days' time. They had
very
no
well.
Idea.
No.
On the 21st of December, the shortest day of the year and the first official day of winter, George Stanton, who was now suffering from snow blindness, exhaustion, malnutrition, was left behind because he couldn't keep up.
Brilliant.
That's the same George Stanton
who led the party
and was giving them directions, and he'd travelled it twice before,
and they're leaving
there and back, and they're leaving him behind. Nobody could do anything to help him. So what did they do? They left him behind to die in the snow. This was the same George Stanton who had risked everything to return from Sutter's Fort with supplies only a few weeks before. And he was the only one who actually knew the route, having travelled it weeks before in each direction. This only left 14 in the Forlorn Hope, and they were now in a more desperate situation. The deep snow, the frostbite, all added to their problems. The two Indians, Louis and Salvador, did their best to lead the group, but a blinding snowstorm intervened and they were now lost in the mountain range. By now, the group were not only starving, but close to mental unbalance. They began to hallucinate as they dragged themselves through the snow. They were hearing strange sounds, eerie noises from the woods, seeing drifting shapes that appeared and then disappeared before their eyes. They actually believed that the ghosts of those who had died on the expedition were actually calling to them.
See, now I believe in ghosts. I don't think that's an impossibility, but I know you're...
I don't believe in ghosts. I believe that...
they were hallucinating.
They were hallucinating. Yeah. And if you're hallucinating and seeing shapes and shadows, it doesn't take much to imagine, you know, you're starving, you've got all the other problems.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to hear things, see things. You've got snow blindness. Mm. And if you don't know what snow blindness is, I will refer you back to Robert Falcon Scott, which was one that I did a couple of...
Yeah. Scott of the Antarctic.
Scott of the Antarctic, yeah. That's another one of your podcasts, isn't it?
Seems to do quite a few.
I've done a couple with you, yeah. But They're still there. They're still in it. They're still in the fight.
They have a little chance at the moment.
23rd of December, the Forlorn Hope climbed the barren, rocky surface of a place called Cisco Butt. It's the highest point in the area. So they're going to be able to get their bearings. They're going to be able to see where they're going to be going. Without Stanton to guide them, they had to find their own route. And the easiest way appeared from this height to be towards the south. The mountains looked less fierce than all of the other directions. So that's what they decided to do. They're going to head south.
Not the way they're supposed to go.
Had they taken a different direction, they would have encountered a place called Johnson Ranch within 3 days. They didn't.
Yeah.
They went south because it looked easier. So they made their way down the mountain into the canyon 3,000 feet below. By Christmas Day, they hadn't eaten for days. Things were bad. They were exceptionally bad. They were so bad that they held a meeting to decide their best course of action. They'd come too far to turn back, and their options were now severely limited. It appears that they'd all thought about it, but one of their party, Patrick Dolan, voiced the thought, one of them might die to save the rest. Dolan proposed that they draw lots to determine who that might be. Funnily enough, it was voted down.
Hmm.
But it was now out there.
Yeah, someone had mentioned
it. Somebody had now mentioned it.
Yeah.
That night, Antonio died in his sleep, as did Billy Graves. Billy Graves was aged 60. On Christmas Day, Patrick Dolan died. But not before he stripped off and tried to walk back to the main camp. He was hallucinating and delusional. Boxing Day, which I don't know, the Americans, do they have a Boxing
No.
Day? No, I don't think they do. Boxing Day is the next day after Christmas Day. It's the day that traditionally servants were given a box by their employer in the
UK.
The UK, and you know, the families that the servants were given a box, and they were given the morning off to go and visit their family.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why it's called Boxing Day. It's nothing to do with the fight.
No. I just thought it was the day that you throw all your boxes away.
No, it was the day that the aristocracy gave their servants a box and gave them the morning off, or some of them the morning and then some of them the afternoon, half a day off to go and visit their own family at Christmas. That's why it's called. So that's a British thing, but it's Boxing Day, if you didn't know. But Boxing Day saw the group depleted by another person, the youngest member of the Forlorn Hope, 12-year-old Lemuel Murphy. He died. His body was laid out beside the other three. It was this time that the cannibalism began. The now desperate group, which had been without food for 6 days, resorted to cutting the flesh from one of their dead companions, roasting it on the fire, and eating it.
Yeah.
There was very little meat on the bodies, virtually no fat whatsoever. You've got to remember, they've walked nearly 2,500 miles over 7 months. So the only nutritious part of the body was the internal organs. Three people refused to eat at the Forlorn Hope. The two Native Americans and a gentleman called William Eddy.
Yep.
They refused. The rest, they ate something.
Hmm.
The whole group remained stranded at this particular site for 4 days, which they later named the Camp of Death. and then they continued on their journey. The group struggled down the trail, barely able to walk. Their feet had become so swollen that the skin had actually burst. They wrapped their feet in rags to try and cushion them, but the pain was so bad that the whole expedition could only travel short distances at a time.
Jeez.
They walked along the edges of icy, rock-strewn cliffs, crossed ravines on fragile bridges of snow, all the time being battered by the snowstorms and the blizzards. They teetered precariously on their snowshoes, but their luck held out. After what seemed an eternity of picking their way along the route,
yeah,
they reached a high point on the ridge, and they paused to take in the view. In the distance, to the west, they could see the vast green plain of the Sacramento Valley. The sight gave them hope, but there were still mountains and canyons that lay in their path, and they had to get through them.
Yeah. It gives you some sort of hope, knowing that you can see your destination.
On New Year's Day, 1847, the meat that they had taken from their companions ran out. The group continued to make slow progress. The 4th of January arrived, and the group was starving again. But they'd reached the snow line, so there was a remote possibility of wildlife. They were so hungry that they took their snowshoes apart and ate the leather that bound them together.
Wow.
Nutrition value was zero.
Yeah.
Next to nothing. Without food and little chance of finding it, it was proposed by Foster that they sacrifice one of their party to enable the others to continue. This is the second time it was voiced. They'd done it.
Yeah, but they didn't kill anyone for it.
But now they want to kill someone.
Yeah.
The two Native Americans were the obvious choice because they weren't part of the original expedition.
And probably had a little bit more meat on them because they hadn't travelled 2,500 miles.
So not agreeing with this suggestion, William Eddy, and remember he was the one that refused to eat.
Yeah. So he's gone, what, 6 days?
Yeah.
He's gone even longer without food.
He warned the two men.
Yeah.
Who, quite sensibly, disappeared into the woods during the night.
Yeah, no shit.
I think I would do as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be me gone. See you later.
The next day, William Eddy left the group with Mary Graves to search for food, and he took the group's only rifle with him.
He was a good hunter, though, wasn't he? He was quite a good marksman.
He was.
Yeah.
It was a good thing he did, because they found and killed a deer.
There you go. Told you he was a good marksman.
Between them, they butchered the deer, dried the meat on a fire before going to sleep. So those two are away from the Forlorn Hope. That night, back at the Forlorn Hope's encampment, Jay Fosdick died. Fearing that William and Mary were not going to return, the remainder of the group cut up and ate parts of him, with the exception of his 22-year-old wife of 1 year, who, believe it or not, refused to do so.
Yeah.
I kind of think that would be...
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't think I'd want to eat. No.
No. The next day, William and Mary actually came back with the deer. The meat from the venison. And the group were now back together. They realised they still had a long way to go, but Foster decided they needed more food in order to continue. He approached William Eddy, requesting that they kill Amanda McCutcheon. And if not her, then one of the sisters. Sarah Fosdick, Mary Graves. Yeah.
Just take your pick, I'm not bothered.
Yeah. William Eddy was so revolted by the suggestion that a fight occurred between the two. They got separated by the rest of the group, at which point William Eddy told the entire group about Foster's request. From that moment on, they all kept an eye on Foster, especially at night while the others were asleep. So somebody always watched him. The problem is William Foster probably liked the taste of the meat.
Yeah.
That's the consensus of opinion by later historians.
I'd have just shot him. Well, he had the gun, didn't he?
Yeah.
I'd have just gone, hey, we need to eat. You're the one that's causing the problem. See you later. Bye. Yeah.
The group moved on from the camp that they'd set up on the 8th of January, but within 2 miles, they came across two people sitting in the snow. Louis and Salvador. Both of them were almost dead. They were still alive, but only just. Yeah. William Eddy wanted to let them die in peace, but the now mentally deranged William Foster shot them.
So he had the gun now.
He then cut them up, dried the meat on the fire. But William Eddy only ate dried grass. He still refused to eat
human flesh.
Yeah.
He doesn't seem like he's going to last very long.
From that night on, only Foster's wife and Harriet Pike camped with Foster. The others kept a safe distance away from one of them, remaining on watch all the time. They're scared of what their former friend might do next.
I'm not surprised.
They continued on, staggering as they walked, and were so weakened and weary that they could only travel for a quarter of a mile or so before they had to stop and rest. The slightest obstacles would cause them to stumble and fall. William Eddy utterly refused to eat any of the food taken from the bodies of Louis or Salvador. He would only eat twigs or dried grass. We did see a number of deer during the next couple of days, but William Eddy was now too weak to even aim the rifle. There's no way on earth.
He wasn't shooting it.
He couldn't shoot him, and there's absolutely no way he was going to give the rifle to Foster.
No.
4 days after their encounter with the two Indians, the group came across an Indian village.
That was probably helpful.
Funnily enough, it was the village that Louis and Salvador had come from.
Ah, maybe not helpful then.
I very much doubt if they mentioned them.
No, probably not. I can't imagine it was a topic of conversation.
No. And I very, really doubt they mentioned what happened to them. They were called the Miwok tribe, and they tried to give them food, but in their emaciated condition, they couldn't eat. Members of the tribe escorted this group towards the nearest white settlement. But eventually, the group's strength gave out.
Yeah.
They all collapsed, unable to continue. William Eddy, however, managed to carry on for a further 5 miles before succumbing to exhaustion and starvation. He was 5 miles from a cabin owned by a Mr. Ritchie. He could go no further. His strength completely failed. But the Indians half carried him, half dragged him, and...
got him.
Well, about half an hour...
Save big on brunch for Mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Before sunset on the 16th of January, the three Indians, Native Americans, with Eddie, starved beyond the point of recognition, came upon the cabin. William Eddie was able to tell them about the remaining members of the Forlorn Hope before he collapsed unconscious for 4 days.
Wow.
The next day, the settlers found what remained of the Forlorn Hope. Of the 17 people who had left the camp a month earlier, only Eddie Foster and 5 of the women had come down from the mountains alive. Their journey had taken 33 days. Once the surviving members of the Forlorn Hope had told their story of their survival, the settlers got together and mounted a rescue party. Remember, it's still winter. It took time to assemble enough provisions. And they also had to wait until the weather allowed a reasonable chance of success. The rescue party of 14 men set off from Sutter's Fort on the 31st of January. Going was really hard, and a number of the rescue party actually turned back. Eventually, the party would number 7 men. The trek through the deep snow was exceptionally hard. Eventually, the pack animals that carried the life-saving food had to be abandoned, and the 7 men loaded up as much as they could carry into backpacks and walked. It took them 3 weeks to get over the mountain range, but eventually they reached the lake. Now, like I said, it's now named the Donner Lake.
Yeah.
At the time, it was called the Truckee Lake. But what they found there was unbelievable. Traipsing across the snow, they saw nothing. Were they in the right place? Silence was eerie. There was no sound at all. They'd found the camp, but it was abandoned.
Hmm.
They called out. They then saw a skeletal figure crawl out of a snowdrift and stagger towards the men. With snow still falling, this apparition made its way towards them. It must have scared the crap out of them. It stopped. "Are you men from California, or do you come from heaven?" Mrs. Murphy said the structures that they had built had been covered by 15 feet of snow, so effectively now they were living under the snow.
Bloody hell.
Several members of the camp had died since they first became stranded, and on that very night another baby died. The rescuers visited both camps, the lake and the Alder Creek. The Alder Creek was where the Donner family had set up.
Which was like 7 miles. Yeah.
They handed out small amounts of food to those still alive, knowing that too much in one go could kill them. They didn't have much anyway, I mean, because they'd had to leave most of it behind when the going got too tough for the animals. It wasn't possible for the rescue party to take all the survivors back. 23 of the strongest were chosen to make the attempt, 7 adults, 16 children. They left as soon as they could. However, a few found going too difficult and turned back. Some days into the walk, the party met up with 10 men on snowshoes coming the other way. This turned out to be a second rescue party heading to the camp. One of this group, James Reed.
Mm-hmm. Might be interesting to know, which I don't think you've got in here, but James Reed, he was actually conscripted into the Union Army at this point.
Yes.
And he was fighting for the United States, obviously for
the Union.
The Union. And when he found out where they were, he left. He just left the army to go and save his family. I think he was given the discharge to do it, but he actually was a soldier at this point.
When he'd got to Sutter's Fort,
yeah,
in order for him to, he knew that he needed to, he knew his family were the other side of the mountains.
Yeah,
he couldn't get enough people to help him. So in order to build up his strength, build up the contacts, build up everything, he actually joined the Union Army to do that. And then, like you said,
got permission to go
and see him.
Which is crazy. You think how many people died in the American Civil War?
Mm.
It was the Civil War, wasn't it? 1847. So
No, it's the American War. The Mexican War.
The Mexican War, wasn't it?
The Mexican War, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because he's in that area.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, I think you'll find that the war actually ended during this time, which is another reason why he was able to leave. Yeah. I'm not 100% sure on that, but I think that is the case. Like I said, this turned out to be the second group. And of course, James Reed was then informed that his wife was still alive.
Yeah. And at the time, his child.
1 week later, on the 1st of March, this second rescue group made it to the lake.
Yeah.
Oh, what a difference a week makes. The condition in both camps had deteriorated drastically. They may not have actually resorted to eating the deceased before the first rescue party arrived, but they would certainly have discussed it. 1 week later, when the second rescuers arrived, things had changed, and not for the better. Dismembered corpses and body parts littered the lakeside camp. A few hundred yards round the lake, the rescuers came to the other camp.
Yeah.
James found his two children, and surprisingly enough, they were in reasonable condition. The rescuers moved 300 yards along the lake to the Murphy's cabin. Mrs. Murphy, who'd been the apparition coming out of the snow, she'd been looking after a number of the camp's children who were horribly dirty and infested with lice, but they were okay.
Yeah.
Mrs. Murphy had not been one of those who had left with the first rescuers, but she had gone mad. James found the body of his wagon driver, Milton Elliot. His face and head were untouched, but the rest of him had been harvested. It's probably the only way of describing it.
Yeah.
The following day, they made it to Alder Creek, which is where the Donner family were. Things were much worse there. Jacob Donner's children were found covered in blood, sitting on a log, eating parts of their dead father. On the ground beside them were bits of hair, bone, skin. Like the first group, this second rescue party distributed food and selected those who they believed could make the return journey. They left with 17 of them on March the 3rd. The Donner family were left at their camp, and this included George Donner, whose arm had now become severely infected after the injury to his hand, and his wife Tamsin had refused to leave.
Yeah.
So she stayed
with
him.
She's not going to leave him to die on his own.
And their children.
Yeah, but she's going to die.
2 days after heading into the mountains, this rescue party got caught in another blizzard. When it cleared, 5-year-old Isaac Donner had died. Most of the refugees and this group were too weak to travel. Reed and another rescuer, Hiram Miller, took 3 of the children with them, hoping to find food that they had stored on the way up. The Breen and the Graves family, along with Mary Donner, claimed that they were too exhausted to make it down the mountain safely. They refused to leave the fire. They stayed put. This place would become known as the Starved Camp. Tired and exhausted, without the remains of food, the remnants of the second relief party and their 3 young survivors struggled on through the mountains. On their way through the mountains, they encountered another party of 7 men. This would be the third rescue party. Two of these members were William Eddy and William Foster.
Yay.
The two from the Forlorn Hope.
They made it.
Fighting the blizzards and the cold, this rescue party found the starved camp on the 12th of March. The camp wasn't quite what you'd expect. There were 11 people still alive. Mrs. Graves and her son Franklin had died along with Isaac Donner, and all three bodies had been cannibalised. After Reed and Miller had left 5 days earlier at the camp, they'd set up a fire. The fire had melted a hole in the snow, and it had melted it all the way down to the frozen earth. The hole was about 15 feet in diameter and 24 feet deep.
Jeez. So you're just walking along and suddenly there's a hole and you look down and there they are huddled round a fire, basically.
Yep. They'd cut steps in the snow wall to allow access in and out of the hole. Three members of that third rescue group, gentlemen called Charles Stone, Howard Oakley and John Stark, decided that they would attempt to get those from the starved camp back through the mountains to safety. This left the remaining men to continue on the rescue mission. And those men arrived at Alder Creek on the 14th of March. They arrived to find George Donner now dying from his hand infection. His wife, Tamsin, even though she appeared in comparatively good health, still refused to leave him. But she did allow her three girls to leave with this group. The relief party soon departed with four more members from the lakeside. That left only five people behind. Those left behind were Louis Kesseberg, Mrs. Lavinia Murphy, and they were at the lake camp, the three Donners at Alder Creek, George, Tamsin, and their little nephew Sammy. Two of the rescuers, Jean-Baptiste Trudeau and Nicholas Clark, elected to stay behind to care for the Donners. 2 days into the return journey, those two men that had volunteered to remain behind caught up with them. There was no real reason for them abandoning the Donners, despite the cold, the blizzards and lack of provisions. All three rescue parties made it back to Sutter's Fort. But those two, Jean-Baptiste Trudeau and Nicholas Clark, never ever gave a reason why they abandoned the three Donners at the lakeside.
I would assume they were probably at the point of no return. I mean, George Donner had that injury, what, a few months now at this point?
He was seriously ill and not
going
to make
it. That was gangrene. He's going to die. His wife's got no intent on leaving him. You can't just stay there waiting for... They're not going to leave, because she wasn't going to leave him. So he was going to die there, and she was, I think, at that point, she'd basically resided to die with him. So, I would have left him as well.
Once the third relief party made it to Sutter's Fort and informed them that there were still survivors in the mountains at the two camps, a few men started out to get them. These men were beaten back by the weather. Remember, the weather is still... It's still an issue. It's still snowing.
It's still winter.
It's still winter.
Yeah.
To be honest, after that, there was little incentive to send a further expedition for those who remained at the camps.
Yeah.
George Donner, Samuel Donner, Lavinia Murphy were almost certainly dead, which left Tamsin Donner and Louis Kesseberg the only probable survivors. They'd been left in two separate camps, one by the lake and one by Alder Creek. Tamsin, who survived until now, was last seen in relatively good health. The weather was improving. She would be able to hunt and find food. Nobody much cared for rescuing Kesseberg anyway. It was the 10th of April, a month after the third relief party, rescue party, whatever you want to call it, returned, that the next team would set out.
And that's almost a year since they actually left, by the way, as well.
They were more of a salvage team than a rescue effort, I would have thought.
Yeah.
This is because most of the families had hidden much of their property, which would need to be recovered.
And gold.
And it was with this in mind that the party set out, to be honest.
Yeah.
There was some agreement that the recovered goods would be divided between the survivors and their rescuers, obviously, and those who had been instrumental in the relief efforts. William Foster, who had been left with the Forlorn Hope, was the only member of the Donner Party to return with this fourth group. The six men left on the 10th of April, and they arrived at Lake Camp...
17th of April.
17th of April.
So a week.
Yes, a week. Makes a difference, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's, I mean, when you think it's taken them months to get over there, and now they can do it in a week...
Yeah.
To show you how close they actually were.
It's actually 5.5 months after the Donner Party had initially been trapped on the wrong side of the mountain.
That's mental, isn't it? It's a long time.
The sight that awaited them put all the other previous horrors to shame. The snow at the camp had melted slightly, revealed some of the cattle and the horses that had died on that first week. Snow had covered them over. They'd previously been covered by several feet of snow, preventing the survivors from finding them and using them for food.
Yeah, I was going to say, that would have been a nice, easy save, wouldn't it? Just eating the cattle that had died.
But now, they were just laying about the camp, untouched. Spread around the camp were what can only be described as numerous human body parts. Legs, arms, skulls, butchered torsos, and all of them had flesh missing. The camp was completely still and appeared empty. They did find a kettle hanging on sticks above an old fire. It's not certain which member of the group looked inside, but it is recorded he wished he hadn't. Inside the kettle was a human liver and pieces of human flesh. Fresh footprints in the snow showed that somebody had been alive quite recently. The rescuers found George Donner at his camp by the old by Alder Creek. He was under a tree, wrapped in a blanket. His skull was open and his brain was missing. His body was stripped of meat in many places, and his gold and silver could not be found. Funny that, eh? Eventually, they found what was left of Tamsin Donner at the lakeside camp. The remains of Mrs. Murphy and little Sammy were also found. This left Lewis Kesberg as the person who must have left the footprints.
Yeah, he's the only one left.
It took some time, but he was located. Kesselberg claimed that Lavina Murphy had died a week after the third relief had left, but his story regarding Tamsin Donner appeared a little bit more suspicious. He claimed that, apparently, after the death of her husband, she had stumbled into his camp. Now, bear in mind, that's 7 miles. The two camps are seven miles away. Yeah,
she didn't stumble.
But she entered his camp mad with grief and determined to cross the mountains there and then to find her daughters. Kesselberg convinced her to stay and wrapped her warmly, but she died overnight from exposure, and Kesselberg had been forced to eat her remains. Despite there being oxen and horses being uncovered by the melting snow. He claimed to have no knowledge of any money belonging to the Donners. Unfortunately for him, a number of the Donners' personal effects were found in his possession, and this included over $500 in gold and silver taken from the Alder camp. And he gave the location of more cash that was buried nearby.
Yeah, how does he know that?
Wonder why, how he would know where it's buried, unless he did it.
Yes.
The whole group left the camp on the 21st of April, and they dragged and took Kesseberg with them. 8 days later, on the 29th of April, the last surviving member of the Donner Party arrived at Sutter's Fort. That is the story of the Donner Party, but it doesn't end there.
I mean, that's mental. Just the thought of all of that. Yeah, go on.
The last visit to the camp was on the 22nd of June 1847, when a military group heading east under the command of General Stephen Watts Kearney arrived at what he called the Cannibal Camp.
Yep.
His Mormon battalion veterans gathered up what human remains they could, buried them inside the Breen cabin, and set it on fire.
Yeah, I think that's a sensible thing to do.
So what happened? You know, after making it back to civilization, Louis Kesseberg was vilified as a cannibal, and he was accused of being a thief and a murderer. And he was tried in court for the murder of six of the Donner Party, but he was acquitted. He became penniless and homeless and died in the Sacramento County Hospital, a hospital for the poor, in 1895. The whereabouts of his grave is unknown.
So he led a shit life afterwards, basically.
So many books have been written about this episode and the causes of the Donner Party's misfortune, but these are my opinions. The whole group started their journey from Springfield too late.
Yep.
I mean, they still managed to join the last wagon train out of Independence that year, but they were running too late.
Should have been earlier.
They were slowed down initially by the high water levels in Kansas at the Blue River. They only packed enough food for 4 months.
Yeah, but that's just stupid, isn't it?
They got persuaded by Hastings to take the untried route.
Yep.
They ignored the warnings about this untried new route. They put their trust in a guidebook written by a person who'd never used the guide.
What got me for that, it's not so much that they listened to that, but it's the fact that there was a note from that guy who wrote that book saying, no, you can't go this way. That's the point where you turn around and go, okay, all right, we've lost a few days, but we're going to have to go back.
One of the big things, they listened to Jim Bridger.
Yeah.
Jim had built up a business supplying pioneers with the essentials required for their journey. But over the years, the Oregon Trail had moved and it now bypassed his premises, causing him to lose business.
Yeah.
The Hastings cutoff would restore his trade.
Yes.
So he would have had an advantage in telling them to take it.
And had they have done it and got through and it was brilliant, Jim Bridger now makes his money back.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, like you said, he's one of the most famous mountain men
ever.
Yeah. So if you're a pioneer group, you've probably heard of him. You go to him, you see him, he says, oh, yeah, that's fine that way. You're going to believe him, aren't you? He's got a bit of a pull in that.
I mean, they took the route, but they didn't have a guide.
Yeah,
they only had the book.
Yeah.
The desert crossing took so long. Well, far too long.
Yeah, longer than what they'd been told as well.
They didn't protect their cattle properly from the Native Americans, and they ran out of food.
I would say they didn't bring enough rifles either.
They had too many late starts. I mean, some days they didn't even start moving till midday.
Yeah, and that's just,
not ridiculous. And the snow arrived early.
Yeah.
The winter of 1846-47 was the worst winter snow ever recorded. it was part of the cause of the Irish potato famine, which claimed over 1 million lives.
That's a big claim to make, because they blame the British for that. And I kind of agree with them.
Tens of thousands in this winter alone.
Yeah.
Died.
Oh, yeah, it was.
It was a bitter cold, both sides of the Atlantic.
Mm. Oh, yeah, well, I mean, we get the weather they get, don't we, just a few months after.
In that winter, in the US, more than 600 Mormon pioneers died in their Nebraska encampment.
Wow.
And that was a settlement.
Hmm.
Now, I mean, side note, a human can go for about 3 weeks without food.
This is what gets me. They resorted to it after 6 days.
Yeah. After a few days, a person starts to feel really hungry. But this feeling diminishes within a day or so, and the body starts to get its nutrients from within, fat, muscles and that. The problem is, if a person then eats something, the body goes back to the beginning and it starts all over again. So you can go for about 3 weeks without food.
Mm.
But the minute you eat something, the body then tries to go back. So you then start from scratch, and it really causes problems. There were 87 emigrants in the Donner Party, plus Louis and Salvador, the two Californian Native Americans who joined them in Nevada, made a total of 89 people. Of those 89 people, 81 were trapped in the mountains. 48 survived, 41 died. 5 women, 14 children, and 22 men died. Mm. 2/3 of the women and children made it.
Yeah.
2/3 of the men died.
Hmm.
All 4 Donner adults, so that's George, Tamsin, Jacob, and Elizabeth, died. Most of the Reeds survived. All of the Breen family survived. The Donner family suffered the most. 4 adults, 4 children dead.
Is there, if I'm right, that one of the Donner children was actually raised by the Breens afterwards?
Quite possibly. Yeah, I didn't go into it afterwards because stopped after they.
No.
My research stopped once they got to Sutter Fort.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. You just think about how many. But I do find that statistic a bit weird, that 2/3 of women survived and 2/3 of the men died. Because you would think in a physical environment like that, men would be a little bit better equipped for it.
You would. And this is controversial for some people. They're going to find
this
out.
This is what I mean.
There is more fat on a female than on a male.
Ah. Okay.
And that is the reason.
I'd have been all right then.
But that's it. The first to die are those that are the fittest.
Yeah, because they've
They've got no reserve
of body fat.
And women, and they've walked 2,500 miles.
Yeah, so they've lost whatever body fat they had spare anyway.
You start walking, what are you going to do? Your family, you walk, your wife and children sit in the wagon.
Mm. Yeah,
so they've got more energy, they've got more. So in reality, yes, but that's the reason why the men died
first. Yeah, I didn't
first.
Think about it like that.
It's a very, very controversial sort of thing, but that's the actual reasoning behind it.
Mm.
There's more fat on a lady than there is on a man.
Yeah. And to be fair, when you think that they
in
have to
these
go...
circumstances, I'll add that to it, just in case I get...
Well, no, I think as a general rule, I don't think that's controversial. I mean, you've got women have to go through childbirth and carrying babies and things like that, so they have to have more support than
more
a man.
Reserve.
Yeah.
Yeah, more energy reserve, more fuel. Yeah.
So, but I mean, I just find it a bit... I just when you think about the story and you think, right, you've got 80 people walking across the wilderness and most of the men are going to die, but most of the women are going to survive, you'd go, nah, that's
Don't happen, does it?
You'd think, no chance.
But yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's crazy. The story itself is just mental. And it's, like I said, there's a few people that have messaged and said, can we do this? And
it's taken me a long time to put it together.
Oh, yeah, I know. I mean, you started this months ago.
I started it last year.
Yeah, and it's just, but it's, there's so much detail in it. I mean, just the, it's so weird because you listen to, like, the Forlorn Hope. And I mean, obviously I know the story, but I'm listening to it and I'm thinking, you're not mentioning the camps. You've not mentioned the camps. But the whole way through it, I'm thinking, well, if this is this bad, what other people... And I know what's happened, but I'm still thinking, it's got to be worse at the camps because they're not moving. And obviously it is, but it's just crazy. I mean, there was at one point, I believe, as well, and I mean, I'm assuming you've done a diff... Obviously where you... the way you've researched it, but I believe at one point where they were talking about this is the Forlorn Hope, when they were talking about actually killing someone to do it, they drew straws, and I don't know if this is true, this might just be something I read, and they spoke about it and they drew straws, and one person actually drew the short straw, and I'm not sure who it was, and then they discussed it and it was like, well, we're not going to do it.
Highly,
and then obviously
likely.
Someone else died. But I don't know if that's
to be honest,
strictly
that
true.
Does sound, it's yeah. highly likely. It
could
possible,
just be another
yeah.
source. But you know, do you know what I mean? It's just,
there are so many. I mean, everything that I've got here, I have checked two or three times.
Yeah. Oh, it's...
So that I know what I've said is not just by one person.
Yeah.
But there are so many. You could do a whole story on the first rescue.
Yeah.
You could do a whole hour on the Forlorn Hope.
Oh, easily.
And we did the first hour.
Yeah.
On Let's Get to the Mountains.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the first
Because you could sum this up, couldn't you?
Yeah.
A group of 80-odd people decide to walk across America, and they got caught in the snow.
And some of them died.
And some of them died because, and in order to survive, a few of them met them.
Yeah.
Well, that's it.
Yeah.
Don't think that would have been quite. You wouldn't. No, have I don't had think many, you wouldn't have had many listeners, would
no,
you?
I don't think we'd have anyone come back for part two of that.
No.
But no, it's crazy. You know, absolutely crazy. I'll say, it's just one of them stories that. I mean, we were sort. Was it Christmas, January, wasn't it, when you came up?
Mm.
So, and my wife asked about it, and we're telling my missus, and she doesn't listen to any of these episodes. But when I was telling her about it, she's like, seriously, you know, it's, you try and explain the story and it's like, wow, like, did that really happen? And you're like, yeah, it's pretty bad.
And it's not the only cannibal story that you can, that exists, you know?
Oh, no, but I mean, it's what, probably one of the more famous ones, especially.
Yeah, to Americans, I don't know if they teach it in America. It's, I know it's part, if you're interested in history, then you would know a little, you would know something about this from an American point of view.
Oh, God, I can't imagine there's many British.
From a British point of view, you probably wouldn't know.
No.
You know, you say the Donner Party and everybody's going to think of a kebab after a Friday night down the pub.
Well, I never, I mean, until someone actually commented on, I think it was the Oregon Trail episode that I did, and somebody commented on it and said, is this the Donner Party? And I was like, I haven't got a clue what that is. Like, because that was my first Donner is a Donner kebab. And I thought, no, I'm going to have to Google that. And I Googled it and I was like, oh, it's just a story about people
traveling
who traveled the Oregon Trail. And then I listened to, I listened to stories, but sort of like read stories to go to sleep, right? Mm. You know, and I put this one on. It was a Wild West one and they were doing Billy the Kid and things like that. And it was, and I fell asleep, and I put on the Donner Party, and I must have listened to... Normally, I'm asleep within 10 minutes, so I only set my timer on it for 15 minutes, because I don't want to miss the story. I'll listen to 15 minutes, and by that point, I'm asleep. And I set it to 15 minutes, and then I set it again, and again, and again, and I must have got maybe an hour and a half into listening to it, and it was like a... like a first-person storybook type thing, you know, like you'd read a normal book. And I was like, wow, this is fantastic. And then I obviously realised what it was and then started to do a little bit more research into it. And it's just mental. Just the whole story is crazy. And there's so many things that they did wrong that...
Yeah, any one of them...
could have changed it.
If they, you know, even if they'd have... God, if they'd have got up earlier on 3 days,
yeah,
they'd have made it.
Yeah.
They missed it by 24 hours. That's what gets me. 24. If they'd have arrived at the top of that mountain...
24 hours
earlier.
Yeah. There'd have been no issue.
There'd have been no issue.
They'd still have been late because the other groups had got there.
The other group had got there a month beforehand. You know.
It's, you know, it's you know, could they have... Should they have just followed the actual route? Did they? Should they have listened to this guide? Should they have listened to the bloke who actually did the route and came back and said, Hastings is talking out of his arse, this is stupid, don't do it. And then they go, nah, so we're going to do it anyway. And then, I mean, even something as simple as, like you've got there, I mean, they didn't protect their cattle properly. If they'd have protected their cattle and food, they probably could have hunkered down in the snow for
a little bit,
6 months. And wouldn't have worried about it if they've got enough food to get them through.
Do you know what gets me? None of the surviving party confronted Hastings.
Did they not?
Nope.
Wow. That's weird. Yeah, that's a bit strange. I've not even thought about that, but yeah.
None of them confronted Hastings. They blamed him. Boy, did they blame him. But none of them actually... confronted him face to face.
I find it strange the guy was that Kesseberg, how he got away with it as well, because when they say like George Donner was found with his skull broken open, well, that doesn't just happen.
No.
You know, had he have been found dead and bits were, but his skull cracks open?
And his wife wouldn't have done it.
No.
Because she wouldn't leave him.
No. She wouldn't have the strength either. So it's, I think that was a bit weird that he got acquitted for that, and maybe... That was
he got his comeuppance, though. Died in poverty in hospital.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Very, very good story. And a two-parter. So that's the first time we've ever done a two-parter. So, yeah. I'm well impressed with that. So, well, thank you for joining us again. Thank you for everyone who's listened. And if you've listened to both episodes, let us know. Drop us a message. We always like a bit of feedback. Just to let us know how it's gone and what you think of the episodes. If you've managed to get through, I mean, I'm just looking at the timer now. We're well over 2 hours and 20 minutes for the two episodes. So, yeah, fantastic. If you've managed to listen through it, let us know what you thought. I can't really say much more than that. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next time. That was quality. Hello there, welcome back. This is part two of the Donner Party, so if you've listened to the first part, welcome back. If you haven't listened to the first part, I think you should probably go back and listen, because you're not really going to understand what's going on. Just a quick one, if you are listening, if you're a follow on, you don't need this warning. If you're just coming into the second part, just a heads up, there is some graphic detail in this one, and it may not be suitable for people who have a nervous disposition or young listeners. Thank you.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.